Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
We need God's law. We need to know His moral demand. We need it for us as a guardrail for our society. We need it as a mirror for our own life so that we can see Jesus, or know that we need Jesus, I should say. And then finally, we need it as a guidebook for our daily walk so that we know something of the heart and the principles of what pleases God. Yes, we need all this, but you know what you need as well? You need the presence of Jesus Christ in your life.
The Old Testament laws are an essential tool in the Christian life, giving us guidelines for how we should conduct ourselves in society and how we can get closer to our perfect God who made us. However, Pastor David reminds us today that the law is not enough to save us. We cannot get to God by merely doing our best and hoping that it'll be good enough. We need Jesus, the fulfillment of the law, whose perfect life was sacrificed so we didn't have to be punished for not being perfect. Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
Exodus chapter 21, verse 1 begins, "Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them." Now these are the judgments. Exodus chapters 21, 22, and 23 complain many laws on a broad variety of subjects. Here's just some of the subjects that they include. It tells us about employment law regarding the treatment of servants. It tells us about the distinctions between murder and manslaughter and violent assault. It speaks to us about the liability for one's animals and the responsibility for the animals of other people. These chapters speak to us about theft, about responsibility, about restitution. It speaks to us about rape, about dowry, and about the value of a woman's virginity. It speaks to us about personal injury and disability insurance. It speaks to us about idolatry and sorcery, about the treatment of disadvantaged people in society, about money and proper lending practices, and it teaches us about justice and equal standing before the law. And that's not even a conclusive list, but I just want to give you the idea that these three chapters, 21, 22, and 23 of Exodus, give us a broad view of many laws that God gave to ancient Israel. And in these laws, we see the character and the wisdom and the love of God on display. For example, in these laws, we see that human life is valued and protected. We see that responsibility on an individual level is required. We see that God commands kindness and compassion in daily living. We see that God is very concerned about justice and fairness. And if I could put it this way, about blind justice. Justice that doesn't care who's before it, but in a blind way, it's going to determine what's right and what's wrong. It speaks to us about how God has a heart to see the vulnerable and the weak protected. About how God wants debts to be repaid. And how restitution for wrong is to be made. It shows us about how the rights of the accused are to be respected. And how crimes are to be prevented. More than anything, it shows us how God is to be honored and a community is to be blessed. Now, it's a marvelous, marvelous section. And that's why I really invite you to take some time out and take a look at this verse-by-verse, in-depth exposition we give to these things on the video segments on our website. But I don't want anybody to get the wrong idea. That's not to say that we could simply take these laws and write them into our own law books today. It isn't so simple as that. Many of these laws presuppose a particular cultural and historic situation that was relevant for ancient Israel, but perhaps not today. I'll just give you one example. Here's one example. Many of these laws presuppose the cultural practice of paying a dowry. Do you know what a dowry was? A dowry is what the groom had to pay to the bride's family before he had the right to marry her. It was a bride price, a dowry. Now, here in the Western world, although there are some places in the world today where the practice of the dowry continues, in the Western world it doesn't. And many of these laws just don't make sense without the practice of the dowry. I'll just give you another example. In these chapters, you'll see the verse where it says, you shall not boil a kid, that is a baby goat, you shall not boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. Now you think, well, that blows my plans for the afternoon. Well, again, no. It's a very relevant law in principle. And when you see what the cultural environment was and what that law meant in principle, okay, it makes sense. But again, we live in a cultural and historic situation that in some ways is very removed. Here's what you need to grab onto. The principles endure. We look behind these laws and we see principles about what they say, about who God is and how he works in our life. That's why he says right here in verse 1, these laws which you shall set before them. You see, God gave them these laws not only for Israel and themselves, but also that they would be the precedent, the principles, the case law by which later things would get decided in Israel. Have you ever walked into a lawyer's office and you see all these books on their shelves? And what they are oftentimes are their law books, their case books, citing precedents and prior cases that help them to decide how the law is to be applied today. In many ways, this right here, these three chapters, make up Israel's case law, their precedents. And by them, the judges of Israel would draw principles by which way they would discern what's just, what's right, what's wrong, what's God's will in a specific situation. So following from verse 1 are dozens of laws given as examples, as precedents, as principles by which they would decide things and order their society. So I find it interesting, and what we're going to do now is we're just going to take a look at a couple of these laws, just a couple. We're going to take a look at a couple of laws, and then we're going to take a look at the conclusion of this section in chapter 23. So for the couple of laws, look now first at the very next verse, Exodus chapter 21, verse 2. What's the very first law God has on his list? What's the first topic, the first subject that he deals with? God has compassion upon slaves in Israel. Take a look at this, verse 2. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Now right there, that very first opening line, verse 2, if you buy a Hebrew servant. There are some people who are immediately shocked and scandalized by that verse, and they say, God here invented slavery and instituted slavery in the ancient world. Did you know that there are some people who try to blame the Bible for slavery? As if Moses, or as if later biblical writers, invented slavery. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, that is an extremely, and I'm going to be as charitable as I can right now. I'm thinking of worse words in my mind, but that is an extremely misinformed position. Slavery existed for centuries before the Bible ever was written. Slavery is normal among human beings. It's always been in the predatory and cruel human nature of mankind to prey upon the weak and the vulnerable and to enslave them for their purposes. It's existed before the Bible. It exists as far outside of the Bible in cultures that the Bible has never touched. The Bible has nothing to do with the establishment of slavery, but the Bible has everything to do with the elimination of slavery. Slavery is alive and well in the world today, and it's tragic, and it's unbiblical, and it's a scourge upon humanity. But in any regard, please notice this. You see, slavery among the ancient Hebrews was very different than what most of us think of as slavery. When most of us think of slavery, our minds instantly sort of go back and we think about the cruel institution of slavery as it was known in the United States, particularly in the 18th and the 19th centuries. And we let that sort of model in our minds, where this is how slavery worked in those times. First of all, people were made slaves because they were kidnapped. They were stolen. And then they were transported into a different place. And then what happened next was that they were slaves for life and could never be free. And all their children, all their descendants were also slaves for life. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know, that doesn't reflect the institution of slavery in ancient Israel at all. Not a bit. Instead, when the Bible describes in verse 2, a Hebrew servant, these are the four basic ways that a Hebrew might become a servant in ancient Israel. Number one, in extreme poverty, somebody might voluntarily sell themselves in service to another person. I'm so poor that I have no prospects for myself. But if I sell myself to you, you'll provide for my needs, I'll work for you, and I'll just be sort of an indentured servant to you. That was one way that somebody might become a servant in ancient Israel. Number two, a father might sell a daughter as a servant to a home with the intention that she would later on marry into the family. And provision is made for that in Exodus chapter 21, verse 7. A very interesting law, which, by the way, is remarkable. I mean, it's remarkable to see how God cares for those who might be otherwise voiceless or have no defense. The third way that a Hebrew might become a slave is in the case of bankruptcy. See, that's how it worked in the ancient world. Not just in Israel, but in the ancient world. They didn't have bankruptcy court like we have it today, where debts are discharged that way. If you had debts that you couldn't pay, you know, your creditor would hang with you for a while, but if it was established you couldn't pay the debts, you couldn't discharge them in bankruptcy. You know what happened to you? You became the slave to who you owed the money to until the money was worked off. An awkward silence descends over the room as people are calculating how many years of servitude that they might have to serve to MasterCard or Visa to take care of that debt. No, but this is the principle, is it not, in the scriptures? That this is how debts were. You didn't just write it off. That actually it had to be settled this way. And then finally, the fourth way that a Hebrew servant would become a slave or a servant is if a thief had nothing with which to pay proper restitution. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but it was another way that somebody might become a slave in ancient Israel. But the ideas of man-stealing, the ideas of permanent servitude, these concepts that many people have of slavery, they simply do not apply to the practice of slavery in the Old Testament. Normally, slavery in ancient Israel was chosen, or at least mutually agreed to. Secondly, it was of limited duration. And thirdly, it was highly regulated. I mean, look at it right there in verse 2. He shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. That's all there is to it. 6 years. Not lifelong. 6 years. So if I owed you a massive debt that I could not pay, I would have to say, okay, I can't pay my debt. I'm going to work for you, but not for the rest of my life. For 6 years at the most, until the debt is discharged, and then I am free. This was the idea. And God had a great concern by making the first law to say, I am going to take care of the needs and make sure that these people in this condition of servitude are not treated badly. Next, chapter 22, verse 1. We're just going to pick out another law to take a look at in greater depth. Just one other law, because I think it's illustrative. Exodus chapter 22, starting at verse 1. It says, if a man steals an ox or a sheep, and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether it is an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall restore double. All right, look, okay, great. God's giving some laws about what to do with slavery. You say, well, wait a minute, with this whole business of thievery and stealing, didn't God say back at the Ten Commandments, you shall not steal? Yes, of course he did. Then why does he feel that he needs to add more here? Because even though he said, do not steal in the Ten Commandments, he did not say what the penalty should be for the one who does steal. Now God details, for the sake of the judges in Israel, what they should do. And that's why verse 1 says, if a man steals an ox or a sheep. Now let me make this clear. What we're talking about here is precedent. We're talking about case law. In other words, it wasn't open season on goats in Israel. Like you say, well, it doesn't say don't steal a goat. It just says an ox or a sheep. No. You take the principle back to this. So in laying down the precedent, certain kinds of animals like oxen, certain kind of animals like sheep, If the theft is made, what does it say? It says, verse 1, he shall restore. You know what I think is amazing about that? The Mosaic Law didn't send people to jail for stealing. What did it do? It said, pay them back. Don't just pay them back, but pay them back with a penalty. You got to make restitution, not just of what you sold, but tack on 4 additional oxen to the ox that you sold. Add a second sheep. The penalty could be anywhere from 500% to 200% for what was stolen from there. Now, you think about that. I could just think of a poor Israelite farmer saying, somebody please steal my ox. I'd like 4 more. But actually, this was a very appropriate and humane way to address the problem of theft. Because actually, I think it's much better than our own system, which tends to emphasize incarceration instead of restitution. In the Old Testament law, emphasizing restitution, first of all, it made it good for the person who suffered the loss. You stole my ox, not only do I get my ox back, you get me 4 more. I'm pretty happy with that arrangement if I'm an Israelite farmer. But secondly, it gave a dignified way for that thief to repent and set things right. You know, sometimes we think too kind of broadly, too kind of, you know, ethereal about this idea of a debt to society. And I believe there is such a thing as a debt to society. But even more than a debt to society, you owe something to the person that you stole it from. So pay him back, put a penalty on top of it, and then you have the dignity of knowing that you've repented and set things right. I think that's a great way. That's a positive approach to the punishment of criminals, putting back into productive restitution and compensating the victims of the theft. Now, by the way, let me say this. I think that this principle of restitution also has tremendous application to the Christian life that we live. I don't say this because I know anything here, but I just say, you've done wrong to people, haven't you? Haven't you done wrong to them? Haven't you stolen from some people? Haven't you injured reputations by your gossip and talebearing? Haven't you sinned against people in other ways? What would God say to your heart about this principle of restitution? You know, sometimes we think it's enough if we just feel bad about what we've done. Okay, great. I hope you feel bad about what you've done. I hope that you pray to God and ask Him to forgive you for that sin. Get it out of the way so that it doesn't hinder fellowship between you and God. I hope that you do that. But would you consider all afresh right now how God would have you pay restitution for what you've done? And I'm not necessarily even talking about paying money, although in some cases that might be appropriate. How about this? Looking for a way, anointed by God's Spirit, that you would go out and set right the wrong that you've done. That you would just not consider your bad feeling inside to be restitution enough. Would God lead you? I think He would, to set it right in some way. So that was God's command. He should make full restitution. And look at it, verse 3. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Well, this is a way that somebody might become a servant in ancient Israel. You steal, but you don't have the money to pay restitution? Fine, you're going to be that person's servant for 6 months or a year, up to 6 years. But then finally, look at this in verse 2. This is also something very sophisticated in the law system of ancient Israel. It says, if the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. What God is doing by laying out these principles is he's saying to ancient Israel, you have the right to protect your home, but you don't have the right to do anything at all times to protect your home. And there's divisions made. There's some circumstances in which more force is appropriate. There's other circumstances in which less force is appropriate. And God left it up to the judges of Israel to decide. But really, it's a wonderful principle. Yes, you have the right to protect your property. No, you don't have the right to do anything to protect your property. It has to be appropriate to the threat and to the circumstances. All right, well, that's these two laws that I just sort of gave as example. In the beginning of chapter 21, about the rights of slaves, in the beginning of chapter 22, about making restitution after a theft and all of that. Now let's go to the end of chapter 23 and take a look at a change. Because chapter 21 is all about these laws for different circumstances. Chapter 22 is all about these laws for different circumstances. And the first 19 verses of chapter 23 are all about these laws in different circumstances. But at verse 20 of chapter 23, it changes. At verse 20 in chapter 3, God is no longer laying out laws. Now he's promising something about his presence. By the way, I think this is very important, sort of as a balance, sort of as an illustration for us. That yes, do we need to hear God's law spoken in our heart? Absolutely we do. You need to hear about God's law, and I need to hear about God's law. I don't doubt that for a moment. We need God's law. We need to know his moral demand. We need it for us as a guardrail for our society. We need it as a mirror for our own life so that we can see Jesus, or know that we need Jesus, I should say. And then finally, we need it as a guidebook for our daily walk so that we know something of the heart and the principles of what pleases God. Yes, we need all this, but, you know what you need as well? You need the presence of Jesus Christ in your life. Have you known some followers of God that they were all about law? Oh, they had the law down on every step. Law this, law that. But they forgot about the presence. And that's what we get to right here, Exodus chapter 23, verse 20. It says, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him." God promised that he would send a supernatural individual there to accompany Israel along the way. He was saying to them, you're not alone. I'm going to send a unique presence, a unique angel, he says. I want you to consider this. Where God says, I send an angel before you, this unique angel commanded obedience from Israel, and he had the right of judgment over them. Most of all, you could say this, and it's at the end of verse 21, my name is in him. Now, who is this angel? Did you know we only know a few angels by name in the Bible? We know the angel Michael by name, and we know the name Gabriel by name. And at the end of first service, I said, well, that's it. That's all we have is those two angels. And then somebody else brought up very helpfully, he said, no, we know another angel by name, the angel Lucifer, who was a fallen angel, but, you know, that's a name nonetheless. But nevertheless, who is it that God promised he would send with Israel? Well, this is what you need to understand, first of all. Both in the ancient Hebrew and in the ancient Greek, that word angel most literally means messenger. And sometimes messengers are not angelic beings. There are some cases in the Old Testament where this divine messenger was actually God himself. And when God himself appears in such a form in the Old Testament, we know that it's a preview of Jesus Christ. It's Jesus himself appearing for us on the pages of the Old Testament before his incarnation in Bethlehem. And that's why it says, verse 21, my name is in him. Did you know that the holy name of Yahweh is in the name of Jesus? It is. Because in Hebrew, you would say the name of Jesus, Yahshua. Yah, short for Yahweh, and Shua, meaning salvation. The name Jesus, Yahshua, means Jehovah is salvation.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. There's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.